1921, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, an incident of racist violence took place, and its impact can still be felt today. That summer, mobs of white rioters stormed through the Greenwood neighborhood in Tulsa. It was known as Black Wall Street, and it was predominantly made up of affluent black people. As the rioters made their way through the neighborhood, they attacked and killed members of the community. They burned buildings to the ground. Historians believe that as many as 300 people may have died. Survivors of the massacre were never compensated for their losses. But this week, nearly a century after the fact, people in Tulsa filed a lawsuit demanding reparations for victims and descendants of the Tulsa race massacre. The lawsuit is led by one of the last remaining survivors of the massacre, 105-year-old Lessie Benningfield Randall. Earlier this summer, the massacre received renewed attention when President Trump planned a campaign rally in Tulsa on Juneteenth, a day celebrating the liberation of enslaved people in the U.S. The backlash was swift for members of the community, who saw the planned rally as a slap in the face to the memory of those who had been killed. The president moved his rally to the following day. I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we break down the fight for reparations in response to the Tulsa massacre, and how this summer's protests might influence the reparations debate moving forward. I'm joined now by William Darity, better known as Sandy. He's a professor of public policy at Duke University and co-author of From Here to Equality: Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. Hi, Sandy.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also with Tiffany Crutcher, founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and descendant of a survivor from the 1921 Tulsa Massacre. Tiffany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So tell us, Tiffany, what is the case for reparations in Tulsa?
Well, the case for reparations is simply this. Almost 100 years ago, my great-grandmother's beloved community, Greenwood, also known as Black Wall Street, was burnt to the ground by mobs of white rioters. And I'm sure you have follow-up questions, but it was never atoned for. We never received compensation, retribution, and they robbed us of our generational wealth. And here we are, almost 100 years later, fighting for those survivors, fighting for the descendants, fighting for the last known living survivor, one of the last known, Bessie Benningfield Randall, in hopes that she would see some form of justice or abatement before God calls her home.
Yeah, I mean, well, so your great-grandmother was a survivor, as you said. Can you tell us her story?
Yes, Rebecca Brown Crutcher is my father's grandmother, and shamefully, unfortunately, I didn't know she endured what she called at the time the Tulsa race riot. I left and went to college, and people would ask, where are you from? And I would tell them Tulsa, Oklahoma. And people from Chicago, LA, New York would immediately say Black Wall Street or the Tulsa race riot. And after the third time, of course, I played it off because I didn't want people to think I didn't know about my own city. I went home and I said, Dad, what are these people talking about? What are my classmates talking about? And that's when he told me about what happened to, we call her Mama Brown, Becca Brown Crutcher. She had to flee in fear of her life. She had a business on Black Wall Street, a barbecue pit, her and her family. And she jumped on the back of a truck to get out of harm's way. And as she was fleeing, I think she went off to some creek land to Muskogee, Oklahoma, which is about 40 miles east of Tulsa. She saw the burning and the killing of unarmed people. And I often stop and ponder, what was she feeling? You know, what was she thinking? What was going through her mind? And a few years later, she whispered to my dad, you know, when Martin Luther King was killed and the riots broke out all over, and she whispered to my dad, that happened here. And my dad had just got back from Vietnam. And my dad said, why are you whispering? And she said, well, they told us if we ever said anything about it, it would happen again. And that's the fear they instilled in our ancestors and those survivors and our beloved, you know, community. And so they never talked about it, which is why we never knew about it. And you'll hear that story throughout our community. They didn't teach us in middle school or high school in Oklahoma history. We learned about the Trail of Tears, but they never taught us what happened to our thriving Black community. And I played on that sacred land and didn't know I was playing on sacred ground.
Sandy, it's interesting when we still hear this term Tulsa race riot, which you know, really, I guess, annoys me. I saw in the New York Times that phrase. It seems to me to really remove the agency of the rioters, if you will, the mob of white people who acted and destroyed these businesses, killed hundreds of people. It was more like what we would refer to as a pogrom or a massacre or even ethnic cleansing. Am I right?
I prefer to use the term massacre to describe what happened in Tulsa. Unfortunately, what happened in Tulsa was one of the more extreme instances of a series of these white terror campaigns that took place across the United States from the end of the Civil War up until the 1940s, which resulted in intimidation of Black Americans, particularly intended to prevent them from participating in the political process. It resulted in the destruction or theft of their personal property, which is something that happened on an extensive basis in Tulsa, and it was accompanied by a series of outright murders of Black people. The year 1919, in particular, 2 years before the Tulsa massacre, featured upwards of 30 to 35 of these pogroms that took place both north and south in the United States, and led to that particular year's summer being referred to as the Red Summer of 1919. It's interesting that the only instance that I believe some form of restitution has actually been made is in the case of Rosewood, Florida, a massacre that took place in 1923, where the state of Florida has made some limited restitution to the victims and their descendants. But that's interesting in another way, because the state of Florida was actually one of the bloodiest states in the United States with respect to these massacres, and no restitution has been provided for the white mob violence that took place in other parts of the state.
Sandy, Tiffany referred to the loss of generational wealth, which is an idea that's really, I think, gained momentum in recent years. How do we understand, how do we quantify this loss when we're talking about reparations?
The beginning of the intergenerational loss actually starts with the deprivation of the formerly enslaved, the deprivation of the 40 acres in restitution that they were promised. At the same time, the federal government was providing 160-acre tracts of land to white families that, in quotes, settled in the western part of the United States. These tracts of land, these allocations went to upwards of 1 million white families that resulted in a situation where today 45 million living white descendants are beneficiaries of those land grants. At the same time, the formerly enslaved were given nothing and therefore did not have an opportunity to transfer wealth across generations. The net effect is that we observe a situation today where Black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but only possess about 2.5% of the nation's wealth. This translates into an average differential across households of $800,000 in a gap in net worth between Black and white households.
That's an average, you're saying?
That's an average.
That's profound, isn't it? Tiffany, what is the racial wealth gap like in Tulsa today?
Oh, wow. Well, whites make 50% more than Blacks here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's just evident. And we make up about 15% of the population here. But if you come to Tulsa, Arun, you'll see that those same railroad tracks that divided the white side of town from the north side of town, from Black Wall Street, those same railroad tracks still symbolize the same thing today. We live in a tale of two cities. And so a child's life expectancy in North Tulsa, which is the black side of town, is 10 years less than a child's life expectancy in another zip code. We live in a food desert. There's blight everywhere. Gentrification, Black Wall Street, 35 to 40 square blocks were burned to the ground. And now our beloved community has been reduced to one block. And the only Black-owned entity is the historic Vernon AME Church in that heart of Greenwood. And that's why we're filing lawsuit. I mean, we're not just filing for a monetary, you know, suit. We want abatement. We want for descendants of survivors to have scholarships for the next 99 years. We feel that we shouldn't have to pay utilities for the next, or taxes for the next 99 years. And we want to sue the Tulsa Development Authority and do a forensic assessment of all of the land. Because when I think about Dr. A.C. Jackson, a prominent black doctor who was coming out of his home during the massacre, as Professor Sandy said, you know, who took over his land? Why don't we own it? Why doesn't one of his descendants, who's a part of this lawsuit, why don't they own that land? And so it's so much bigger than the monetary portion of this. I think about the descendant of J.B. Stratford. J.B. Stratford owned the nicest hotel as a black person in the nation. Just think about what he could have become. He could have been the Hyatt Hotel. He could have been Marriott. He could have been Hilton. They robbed us of our potential, of our dreams. They stripped us of our spirit. And so it is so much bigger than the monetary. And it was the white supremacist policies and tactics and white people controlling the narrative. That's why they called it a riot, because there's a statute of limitation on riots. That was by design. And it should have been called a massacre from the beginning, because there's no statute of limitation on murder.
Sandy, we've seen the reparations debate really enter the mainstream, I think, just in the last year or so. Are you surprised?
Yes, I am surprised. And I'm somewhat taken aback and excited about the prospect of there being a serious national conversation about reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
Is it easier to talk about this in regard to particular episodes of violence, like in Tulsa, than it is to talk about it in the abstract at a national level, when we're talking about like tens of millions of people and centuries of history bearing down on the present?
So I think specific episodes of atrocities really make tangible to the American people the horrors that have been inflicted on Black Americans. But I don't think it's that difficult to really appreciate the national atrocities collectively without itemizing each individual event. And so what we've argued in From Here to Equality is that there are three phases of injustice that have to be taken into consideration. The first is obviously the period of slavery. The second, though, is what people do not pay as much attention to in thinking about reparations, which is nearly 100 years of legal segregation accompanied by these waves of mob violence that we've been talking about, best exemplified by what happened in Tulsa. And then the third phase is the post-Civil Rights Act period, where we have continued to have mass incarceration, ongoing police executions of unarmed blacks, the persistence of discrimination in employment, housing, and credit markets, as well as the subject that I emphasized, this enormous racial wealth disparity between blacks and whites in the United States.
So given that context, what would reparations actually look like in practice?
From the perspective that we advance in From Here to Equality, we argue that the primary objective of a reparations project would be to provide Black Americans with the material basis for full citizenship in the United States, full citizenship that's been continuously denied. And that would require eliminating in its entirety the Black-white wealth differential. So we estimate that this would require a national expense of $10 to $12 trillion to provide adequate restitution to erase the wealth differential, that these funds should be distributed to individual eligible recipients, and the eligible community should be individuals who have an ancestral connection to chattel slavery in the United States and who are living their lives in the context of being Black in a society that has a long history of racism.
William Sandy Darity is a professor of public policy at Duke University and author of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. Tiffany Crutcher is the founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and a descendant of the 1921 Tulsa Massacre. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.